This week on Unforgotten.
Paula Ellis was born in Birmingham on May 7, 1954, to Betty and Charles Ellis. She went on to follow in the footsteps of her parents when she decided to attend the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa.
Late Saturday evening, April 21st, 1973, Paula went to dinner with friends to the cotton patch in Utah.
So somebody had found her purse on a bridge.
Later, Investigator Fields decided he wanted to go back and search the area again. After arriving, he walked up the road about 100 yards and found Paula in a grassy ditch.
There were tire marks in the grass showing that.
And as we found in many of these older cases, it seems that evidence, including her clothing, was eventually all lost. Dr. Ellis was quoted in the Birmingham Post, "You learn to live with it because you have to. But I still think, why did it have to happen to her?"
Let's solve Paula's case.
Hey everyone, this is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten,
where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
And now for episode 41, Paula Ellis. Stormy here. As you know, we had postponed this episode a week due to some additional information and possible interviews. We haven't been able to connect with the person we hope to yet, but we'll keep working on that. And so if we do, we'll try to bring you an update. But fortune was still with us, and I was able to have an interview with Captain Jack Kennedy of the Tuscaloosa County Sheriff's Office Violent Crimes Unit to discuss Paula's case. He was very gracious and willing to help and had quite a bit of insight. He didn't have the complete file there to look at, so some details we don't have confirmation about still, but some details, of course, we can't share anyway. We are looking forward to connecting more with Captain Kennedy in the near future. And with that, here's our episode.
Hey, guys, and welcome back.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Terrific.
Took a little bit of a...
what the audience doesn't know is this is like the butt crack of dawn right now that we're doing this. So.
I know. Sorry.
Nah, it's not your fault. It's probably more my fault. But hey, you know, we do what it takes to get the story out, right?
It might turn out better. We might find a new time to do things. We'll see.
Yeah. My husband won't be too happy about that, though.
Yeah. Sorry. I took a little bit of a vacation last week, just a couple of days, and it was so nice. The weather was beautiful.
I saw pictures. It looked like it was just fun. I'm kind of jealous.
Yeah, we went down to the beach. So I was playing with my nephew and niece, and like, I had dumped a sand bucket of water on him. And he decided he was going to get me back, but he only scooped up the water where it had like washed up onto the sand. Like,
yeah.
Basically it's coming back into the ocean. And so when he scooped it up, he managed to scoop up mostly sand and shells.
Eek.
And it went into my eye.
Oh no.
And I think my eye is like, it's bugging me today. Days later, feels a little delayed, but that's the only thing that I can think of that would have caused it. Yeah. So, it's really annoying at the moment. But so I'm chasing him around and I was going to like pick him up and go throw him in the water. And he is a lot heavier than he looks. And so I went to pick him up at the waist and kind of like flip him over. What's a downward slope right there, and he's like laughing and moving around. And as I pick him up, I lose my footing and we just crash. And I have a massive bruise from where I fell. And I was like, man, that sand really did a number on me. I didn't realize I had the bruise. But like, it's right where I sit down.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I was going to say, it sounds like it a hurts. Thumb bruise.
Oh, my gosh. It hurts. I was like, well, okay. Note to self, you are not as young as you used to be.
Yeah.
So, lesson
age,
learned.
Age does get us, doesn't it?
Yep. Yep.
Probably me and you.
Awesome.
But we won't go there.
I feel like I'm a lot younger than I actually am.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good thing. If you feel younger, that's good.
Well, I in my head, but then I get a reminder like this. No, just kidding. Yeah. You're wrong. For those who might have missed it, we shared a post on our social media pages this week. Dr. Holly, we love the Hollies. They are just genuinely like the best people. Yeah. And so a few weeks ago, Dr. Holly sent us a message and he was like, I've been working on something. I bought this jewelry kit and I was thinking we could send it out with donations that are given through the page. And so he sent us a few pictures of what he was doing. And so I actually went and stayed with them last Sunday. And when I got there, he was like, oh, let me show you what I've been doing. And he has a whole area set up for this. And it just, I didn't even know what to say because he has really like gone to town making what he calls the drops, which are the necklaces with the little angels on them.
Yeah.
And bracelets and earrings. And he has sets that match each other. And they are so pretty.
I was so taken aback by it when he first told us. I was like, you know, kind of an unassuming thing for, you know, a retired doctor down in Alabama to be doing. And he is just terrific at it. He's like very talented.
He has done a really good job with it. And it was really just a thoughtful thing, a genuinely thoughtful, kind thing for him to do. And I'm really excited about being able to send those out. So if you haven't seen the post, go check those out. And like I said, we're sending those out. You can make a donation through our website. And donations that are made are actually tax deductible now that we have our nonprofit status. So all you have to do, you know, you go to the website. There's a support button at the top. And it says donate. When you click on support, it'll give you a drop-down menu. And you can either go to the support tab or you can go to the petition to sign the petition to the legislature. But we'll get an email when the donations comes through and we'll send it out to you. I think there's actually a spot in there for a note and you can just let us know if you have a preference about, you know, what you get. But they're really pretty and it really is a great idea. I love what he's doing.
I do too.
And I'm just so thankful to him for doing it too.
I can't wait to get mine.
I will be sticking that in the mail to you.
Yay.
So this week on Unforgotten, we're headed to Tuscaloosa County. Nestled in the heart of West Central Alabama, Tuscaloosa County boasts a rich tapestry of history and culture. It's the birthplace of legendary blues singer Dinah Washington and football icon John Stallworth. But perhaps its most well-known claim to fame is being the stomping ground of iconic football coach Paul Bear Bryant and home to the University of Alabama. I'm not going to say it. If you want to say it for me, you can.
I'm not going to say it, but I'm going to apologize. I'm so sorry that it came up again.
I know.
One of these days, somebody's going to be from your alma mater.
I can give it a one-time thing. Roll Tide.
Oh, look at you. And what a good sport you are. Founded in 1818, Tuscaloosa County stands as one of Alabama's oldest counties. To the north, the Appalachian Highlands stretch into the county, offering breathtaking vistas and outdoor adventures. As you journey southward, the terrain gradually shifts from rocky ruggedness
to the gentle, flat expanses of the Gulf Coastal Plain, painting a diverse landscape that defines Tuscaloosa County's unique charm. At its heart lies the city of Tuscaloosa, once Alabama's capital from 1826 to 1845, now the county's largest urban hub. It is also the largest city in the county. However, on the evening of April 21st, 1973, the streets of Tuscaloosa bore witness to the events leading up to the disappearance and murder of Paula Lee Ellis, a promising 18-year-old student at the University of Alabama.
Paula Ellis was born in Birmingham on May 7, 1954, to Betty and Charles Ellis. She and her brother Chuck, Charles Jr., were close. He had given her the nickname Babbis in their childhood, and she would call him Chucker. In the Birmingham Post-Herald, Chuck mentions her fun-loving style and her smile. In her early childhood, the Ellis family moved to Florida. She was a former Southwest Miami high school cheerleader, and she went on to follow in the footsteps of her parents when she decided to attend the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. Making several college friends, Paula was outgoing and participated in many college campus activities. Paula was a good student, interested in majoring in education and staying in the Martha Parham dormitory. She was just finishing her freshman year in the spring of 1973. Looking forward to the following year, she had just pledged to the Pi Beta Phi sorority for her sophomore year.
Late Saturday evening, April 21st, 1973, Paula went to dinner with friends to the Cotton Patch in Utah, a dining place that was well known to college students. It was sometime around midnight that night that she and one of her male friends stopped by to check on her brother before going back to campus. You see, another tragedy had happened in her family for her brother before anything would transpire for Paula. The day before, Chuck's girlfriend was killed in a car wreck, and he was supposed to be leaving early that Sunday morning to drive to the funeral in Enterprise. So she wanted to see him and try to be supportive before he had to go the next day. According to Chuck, in an article in the Birmingham Post-Herald, she had even told another friend in the apartments to be nice to me because no one else close to me had ever died before. The three visited briefly, and then Paula and her friend left.
Sometime that day or evening, Paula had also decided to go to the Woods Quad on campus to watch the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. She had asked some of her friends to go, but none of them wanted to go given that it was going to be kind of late. And since it was a short distance from her dorm, Paula decided to take her bike to the concert. The concert itself was like most festivals, with a few different bands playing throughout the evening. And it seemed pretty common for students to attend these all-night concerts that came occasionally to the quad during the spring.
To give us a little better understanding of the concert festival and the lay of the land at the campus, here is Captain Kennedy with insight into the University of Alabama's spring campus experience at the time.
Anyway, it was Easter weekend. It was 24 hours or 36 hours long. So when I went to the University of Alabama myself, you know, we had a little tiny amphitheater and all that. Anyway, they'd have like, hey man, on this date, there's going to be 10 bands playing free.
Wow.
Just show your university ID, you know, like part of your fees paid for this. And we're going to have 10 local bands finally hit. It's going to start at 12 in the afternoon. It's going to end at like 2 a.m. with the headliner.
Wow.
And, you know, they would just be like, yeah, we'd have that stuff all the time. And you could just go by multiple times a day. So this was in the 70s, but it's just amazing how things have changed.
Yeah.
You know, so this was 1973. Now, here's another big misconception for you, too. So anybody who's familiar with the University of Alabama, we have a giant green space in the middle of campus called the Quad. It's not where this was.
It wasn't.
Not
oh.
Not where this was. It might be easier for you to look this up on Google Earth. Okay, so you see the big green space, it's the quad, right? It's mm-hmm. the big one. It's like between Colonial University and Capstone Drive. Half of it's wooded and half of it's kind of open. And then, you know, on the north end of that, there's a giant building, and that's the giant university library. So that's the quad. So if anybody is, you know, in a football game, that thing's nothing but tents. During the rest of the year, there's people sleeping, playing frisbee, right, walking to classes constantly, getting pictures made, you know, so everybody knows where the quad is. We got this little bell tower called Denny Chimes on the south end, right, that rings bells every 15 minutes and on the hour, you know, that's not where this was. if you go straight north, one block, and on my Google Earth, it even says Woods Quad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
But then you'll see there's a set of buildings in a square. It almost looks like a castle. That is one of the oldest buildings on campus, and that was part of the original rebuilt University of Alabama there. That's now the headquarters of Arts and Science. And that quad in the middle there was like the original thing. That's the quad where this concert was being held. You know, you're surrounded by buildings, and they had a stage on one end or the other, I don't know. But people could come and go as they pleased. It started in the afternoon with magic shows, probably local politicians speaking, who knows what, comedians, choirs, the university choir, the university band. They had a giant 24-hour schedule and led up to, you know, eventually the headliners with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band
yeah.
the next night. And then after that, they showed horror movies, like old horror movies. Like
oh, Dracula. Really?
It went on all the way to like 9 or 10 o'clock the next morning. And the local radio stations were out there with their remotes. There was a small fair. So that was the event. So everybody talks about it was the Nitty Gritty Dirt Man. It was, but that they were the headlining band, you know, at right. prime time.
After this, there are mixed reports that someone may have seen her around 2 a.m., but there's been no confirmation that anyone saw her after she left her dorm.
In the waking hours of Sunday morning, which also happened to be Easter Sunday, April 22nd, 1973, she hadn't returned. Some early articles time this at about 7:40 a.m., but the accounts from investigators quoted in various articles say that at about 9 a.m., investigator Irvin Fields with the UA Police Department received a call from Northport PD informing them that Paula's purse and contents had been scattered on a bridge there, only about 7 miles from UA. And it appeared that someone had tried to discard her belongings into the creek from a moving vehicle, only about 7 miles from UA. At the time, that was all they found.
So somebody had found her purse on a bridge.
Okay.
And the roommate was like, yeah, last night I saw her last night going to the quad or the party or the concert. I think that what really spurred it was her purse with her ID and everything getting found on that bridge.
Yeah.
And well, then the cops come and try to return it to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then her roommate going, well, I ain't seen her since last night. So
gotcha.
Then they just kind of sort of slowly started kind of looking for her. You know, it wasn't an emergency or anything.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, you know, we got this purse, we don't know where she's at, you know, I mean, which ain't no emergency. I mean, they're university students, who knows, you know, where she's at.
Yeah.
But I think that's how that happened.
Investigator Fields decided he wanted to go back and search the area again, paying closer attention to the sides of the road. After arriving, he walked up the road about 100 yards and found Paula in a grassy ditch off the side of the road.
You know, it looked like a vehicle had pulled off the side of the road.
Okay.
There were tire marks in the grass showing that it appeared she had been dumped or pushed out of a vehicle. So
yeah.
Literally, surely a vehicle stopped and she got it was placed outside the vehicle or whatever.
That is...
I know. Can you imagine?
18 years old.
She's
and just, you know, doing what normal college yeah. kids do.
Yeah. I mean, heck, it wasn't even very far from where she, you know, lived. So whoever found her likely found her very close to home, or her temporary home.
This wonderful young woman who is just embarking on her promising life and only 3 weeks away from her 19th birthday had been thrown from a moving vehicle after being strangled to death. Partially nude, some of her clothing was scattered nearby. Around the same time as Fields was discovering Paula, her bike was found standing in a bike rack at the quad. They're not sure if she ever even made it to the concert area. Of note, though Paula was not fully clothed when she was found, it was determined that she had not been sexually assaulted. The medical examiner who performed the autopsy stated the method used to kill her appeared to be a belt. The investigation seemed to yield several leads initially, all being ruled out at the time. And causing more issues, it seemed that there was a lack of coordination among law enforcement. Campus Police, Tuscaloosa Police, and Tuscaloosa County Sheriff's Office all participated in the investigation, and communication was chaotic, as I imagine it would be when you have that many different people kind of involved.
Yeah.
And as we found in many of these older cases, it seems that evidence, including her clothing, was eventually all lost. In 2014, the Crimson White attempted to obtain records, but they were given a response from a lawyer at the sheriff's office with the standard reply that the investigative reports are protected from disclosure, which is pretty standard, unfortunately.
Yes. This is such a conversation we seem to be having a lot lately. I mean, I think we've always had this conversation, but it just seems more and more we're stumbling upon.
I think that I always go back to that opinion that came down from the Supreme Court in the last few years. I think it was like 2021 or 2022. And I think it was the Laniat versus Baldwin County Sheriff's Office opinion. And there was only one dissenting opinion in it. And there was a statement in that dissenting opinion that said there was nothing stopping any agency from voluntarily releasing information. You know, the reason this was in place was to, you know, provide agencies an avenue to protect information that would, you know, hinder their investigation. But it shouldn't mean they weren't required to disclose some information. And it should be construed narrowly in favor of public disclosure. And so somehow over the years, you know, that's just fell by the wayside. And more times than not, nothing is provided. When all that's out there is articles from the time, or are articles from the time, because that was terrible grammar on my part, then who knows whether or not they're accurate, because we talk about this, that different papers report different things, and sometimes, you know, it's a little bit like playing Chinese telephone and things get lost in translation or misprinted or whatever. And if there aren't any updates or clarifications done, then that's the information that the public has to go on. And so when you're trying to get tips and information and they're going based off inaccurate information, you're not going to get very reliable tips to produce those leads that you need. And so coming out and doing an update and sometimes releasing information that maybe hasn't been released before, but isn't something that is so substantial or critical to the case that it would hinder any kind of potential prosecution, can make a huge difference.
I know, it can just jog somebody's memory. You know, just the smallest thing might just spark something. Oh, hey, I was at that concert. You know, I remember, you know, seeing somebody, you know, off in the distance or something, you know, but just the smallest thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, this also kind of reminds me, you were talking about the differences, you know, when I first put that card out, you know, our normal case card, it was, I had read like three articles that were completely different. So I actually went in and updated the card.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free, select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
You know, one thing that I was, when I was reading through kind of, I think it was the Crimson White article, and it could have been a different one because I read a couple of different articles, was that after Paula's murder, they kind of formed the Tuscaloosa County Homicide Unit.
Yeah.
Over at the Tuscaloosa County Sheriff's Office. And so that was supposed to help eliminate this confusion and chaos between all of these different agencies being involved.
Right. Yeah.
And I actually really like this idea.
The Paula Ellis case is why we have a violent crimes unit. But that's really important because we still have, and you know, I know we had these issues with some of the physical evidence has either been purged or disappeared over the years. But all of the records, the paper records and all the investigative files have never left the sheriff's office possession. Mm-hmm. And like you said, this case was, there's stuff happened in Norfolk, there's stuff happened at the university police, there's stuff that happened at TPD, the state troopers even came in. But that's why this was founded. So it's all these cases like that. You know, had we not had this permanent task force that works these cases and is a repository of everything, then when these cases go stale or go cold and something comes up later, then, you know, I have a hard time reconstructing some of them now. But mm-hmm. you can only imagine, I have no idea if it was just, oh, so-and-so police department has a report on file.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you go read that report and they're like, oh, this was a major incident. Y'all had cops from all over America here. Where's all their stuff? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what would happen. And that, so that is a huge strength to us having this permanent task. It works really well. And because I'm going to tell you, even working a regular case now, like sometimes we'll have, I don't know, somebody overdoses or something and they do an autopsy and then the autopsy comes back and say, no, actually they got, you know, stabbed or something. Then it comes to us. It's like just going back and go, well, the medics came here and the fire department from this city came and the hospital did this and this police department did this and now we got autopsy records from the state. And just doing those in reverse is difficult.
Yeah.
So it would be incredibly difficult to do something from a case 20 years ago. We just opened like a new $20 million facility, controlled storage for all evidence and records and everything. It's incredible. It has like, you know, we have rolling racks that are 25 feet high. You have to go in on these big rolling ladders to even get to the top. Mm-hmm. Everything's like in a climate control. We have all our physical evidence and all of our records and everything in this new facility. And it's incredible.
Right.
But this other room has got humidity control and a full climate control and a backup generator. And that's where we put all of our sexual assault evidence.
Oh, that's great.
Because
yeah.
that stuff's heavy on DNA.
Uh-huh.
And so hopefully that would keep DNA and stuff fresher for longer.
Right.
So, because, you know, we had a case, actually I worked this case, we had a serial rapist that had never been solved. We had one university student in 1990, a realtor in Tuscaloosa in 2001, and a woman in Colorado in 2004.
Oh, yeah.
And we were able to do that genetic genealogy because we still had that evidence 20 years later, and it was still valid.
That's great.
And so that testing wasn't available, right, when that sexual assault evidence was recovered, and we were able to identify that guy. So that was last year, so.
Since it has jurisdiction over all of the county's violent crimes, like that seems like that would really be helpful. It's kind of like what we were talking about when we started the petition, is that there needs to be some kind of review board or panel or something to review these cold cases to keep them active. Because like, what is active?
And right, so exactly. Yeah.
You have all of these, you know, hot cases coming in that are taking priority over the colder cases. You call them hot cases, like then they, what are they warmer? And then they turn cold, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
And so it gives you the extra eyes.
Yeah.
Because this is specifically for violent crimes.
Mm-hmm. Specifically for violent crimes such as murder and kidnapping and that sort of thing.
And that's needed.
Yep.
Across the board, really.
It is.
Because things do get so backed up with so many other things that are coming in, and then it takes the focus off these.
And I have to say, I'm encouraged by it.
You know, we were talking about this recently. There's a difference in, or I think actually, with some of our fellow podcaster friends.
I was just going to say, we were having that conversation.
You know, mm-hmm. about the response that you get from sheriff's offices versus municipalities.
Right.
And I think generally you get a better response. Not always. Not always. But it seems to be a pattern anyway. Mm-hmm. That they're a little more willing to talk to you. I mean, obviously, they told Crimson White that they couldn't release the records, but that's not anything unusual.
Yeah.
That happens all the time, and that's unfortunate. I really think that there's really got to be something done different about that.
I know.
Especially when you are looking at a case that is this old. I mean, that was in 2014, and there could have been a change of hands, you know, by now. But, you know, as people change, opinions change for people mm-hmm. over time in general. Right. And, you know, so it could be that the thought process there is different or whatever. And I just don't see where it's really beneficial. And maybe that's just me coming as just the person off the street. Not yeah. having any useful information to see where it would have any value when you're kind of stuck dead in the water to not release it. And then like in this case, you know, they've said there were so many different agencies that were involved to begin with, which was why they created this kind of central unit. Even after that was created, all of the evidence was supposed to be sent to this central unit to keep it from being lost, to help maintain that chain of custody. But
in this particular instance, it was, yeah.
Yeah, because there were so many people with their hands in it. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just there were so many different agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Paper doesn't last forever. It's not,
right.
You know, writing, especially if you've like written pencil or pen or something, gets wet or it gets ripped or starts fading, mm-hmm. it's smudged, whatever, you know.
Well, and you and I have both looked at old records where they've like written notes on envelopes and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever happened to be there, you know, at the time that they got a call or, you know, whatever.
Oh my gosh.
There were lots of tips that came in. So,
yeah. And Bonnie sent us, you know, from the archives
mm-hmm.
in one of the cases, and there was like a post-it. Yeah. Stuck to one of the papers, and it literally said secret question mark call something. And it was like stuck to a thing. And like, but there was no name or anything on it.
Right.
It was just a note somebody had wrote down. And so you see stuff like that all the time. And it's like, okay, what is that? Now a lot of stuff's computerized. It's a lot easier to maintain, organize right. and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing is not only do you have that kind of thing going on with, you know, trying to release something that will jog memories, but just in losing the evidence itself, you know, they say that she wasn't sexually assaulted, but this is 1973. Do they 100% know that? I mean, they may, given things that we don't know.
Right.
But back then, you know, given the fact that she was partially nude, is there a chance that she actually was and the testing just wasn't sufficient enough then? And if they had had the evidence now to test, they could suss that out.
Could it, yeah, would it have different results now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like such a strange situation, I guess, for there not to have been sexual mm-hmm. assault.
It does.
But there may be reasons that lead them to believe that it didn't happen beyond that. But did yeah. they have testing? Like, I don't really know what the testing procedures would have been back then.
Yeah. And I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it was just they say sure she they was did. Partially nude, but they didn't really say exactly how.
I know that I read they found her pants. They had the pants at one point. They're not sure who had the pants, which agency had her pants. And those did not make it to the homicide unit.
Right, right.
And they're like, what could we have found with her pants? Like, could there have been DNA left on her pants or anything mm-hmm. like that? We know they were found. They just didn't make it here. At least yeah. that was what was stated in an article.
Right.
I know
whether
that they,
or not that's true, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I know they kind of determined this pretty early on, but it may have been kind of solidified with some of the other cases that they had been considering could have been related. And that also didn't seem to be sexually assaulted, but had some similarities to the case. So, you know, that could be partially, you know, why they kept that train of thought.
It does. So a couple of the cases that have been kind of speculated on throughout the years was, so in like 2014, the Crimson and White did a pretty detailed article on Paula's case and several others. It's actually very well written. I thought they did a great job on it.
Yeah.
And they actually talked to Wayne Murphy, who had was a retired investigator from the sheriff's office. And according to the article, Murphy thought the killer was a man by the name of Charles Michael Brewer, who had been convicted of murdering a woman named Diana Lynn Holland in 1980. So he was convicted in 83, and apparently Diana had been beaten and strangled and then left on the bank of the Sipsey River.
Right.
She was from Alberta City, which was apparently only 3 miles from the dorm that Paula lived in, and about 8 miles or so from where Paula was actually found in Northport. And they didn't think Diana had been sexually assaulted either.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, that is kind of interesting. The one difference kind of there is that Brewer was apparently living in the same apartments at the time as Diana Lynn.
Right.
So that's a little bit different, I guess, in that he wouldn't have been living in the same dorms. But that doesn't necessarily mean...
But it was really close by, so... You know,
he didn't venture out. I mean, that's a really small area.
You know, and he could have been, you know, 83, that, or 80, that's not 10 years later, but it's several years later. You know, he might have been thinking he was getting away with things and was just being less careful.
And she was 20 years old, too, so, mm-hmm. you know, around the same age.
Yep.
I'd be interested to look more at hers to see, like, what, did she have any kind of physical traits that matched Paula's? I know that she did wear leg braces.
He was also previously convicted of an attack on an 18-year-old girl named Wanda Reedy Smith, who was returning home from work around midnight. That was in December of the same year. And... it was close to midnight. She had apparently dated Brewer a couple of times. And on her way home, she kind of saw him, I guess, crossing paths on the highway. So they turned off and met at a parking lot. And he proceeded. He didn't even, like, it wasn't even friendly. Like, he got in the car and then apprehended her. He mm-hmm. actually, like, immediately opened the door and threatened her and told her to scoot over and tried choking her with an extension cord and knocked her unconscious. It didn't really say and I'm sorry, I don't have the article in front of me, but it didn't really say in the article why he left. So I don't know if somebody went by and it scared him off, or he thought that she had already been passed away because she was unconscious. But he left her there and she survived it.
It almost makes me wonder if they actually did have a relationship, if it was one of those things where it was a relationship, like he didn't know Diana Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
That's a stranger thing. So it's a little bit different.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Yeah.
When it comes to somebody that you've dated and you've cared about, do you actually have the ability to go through with killing them? But I think probably if you have the ability to kill anybody, then
yeah.
You know, but there is, with some people, there are things that will make them stop.
Right.
And then Betty Lou White went missing in Northport in December of 1980. She's never been located, and allegedly they suspect Charles Brewer murdered her too.
Mm-hmm.
She reportedly told a friend that he had been, she reportedly told a friend that Brewer had told her he was guilty of an act that he was being investigated for. But that's kind of hearsay.
Yeah, it definitely is hearsay.
But
and I don't know how far that was investigated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but she's been missing since. She's never been found.
Yeah. And then in 87, there was 24-year-old Shanda Feller, who mm-hmm. was a kindergarten teacher and graduate student over at University of Alabama. I think we've actually talked about her case before. I know we have a case card mm-hmm. on her.
Yeah, we do.
She went to the pool over on the campus, and people saw her at the pool. She was supposed to be meeting with a group of other students for like a study session later that afternoon. Her sister came by to borrow some records and found a note on the apartment door where the students had come by for the study session, and she wasn't there. And they like left a note on the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ended up finding Shanda's body in the Black Warrior River.
Yeah.
And so.
And the pool, which I did not know this before, the pool was like on the north end of the campus. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was actually on the north end of the UA campus. So it was right there too.
And kind of in that same area.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, obviously that's speculation, but still. Kind of a coincidence.
I know. Same. You got to look for similarities. And the profiling of that said it was likely someone who admired her.
Mm-hmm.
Someone local, most likely, because mm-hmm. she'd been weighted down to conceal her death. But it was uncertain whether or not she had been sexually assaulted because she had been underwater for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Her cause of death was likely suffocation or drowning. But again, because she had been in the water for a while, decomposition was a little bit different. It made it a little bit harder to actually, I guess, have a solid confirmation or determination on some of these things.
Right, right. There was also a Jane Doe that was found in 1982 on the banks of the Black Warrior River. In Romulus, and I didn't look to see how close that was to all of this, but I don't know if you know where Romulus is, but she had also died by strangulation, so right there on the Black Warrior River. She's actually still unidentified, so.
Sometimes I get hung up on when you look at the images that have been done.
Mm-hmm.
You think, oh, that's exactly what they look like, and that's not necessarily true. This is just the best guess. So you kind of have to like look at it with a little bit of like a broader eye, and there are things that could be a little bit different because they have the pictures that they posted are phenomenal, actually, that they did the new images. But they said they knew, they know that she was a white female, 5'3", with about shoulder length, black, brown hair, brown eyes, mm-hmm. and type O blood, and that she wore a size 7 tennis shoe. The medical examiner believed that she had previously been pregnant or had mm-hmm. given birth to a child sometime before her death. So, I mean, they have a lot of specifics on her. And, you know, Shanda Feller had black, brown hair around the same length, too. And I think mm-hmm. she had brown eyes.
Yep.
I can't remember exactly how tall she was, but, I mean, very similar characteristics.
The next one that I noticed that really doesn't quite fit the bill, but still, you know, is an unsolved case, which is Brenda K. Green.
Her hair and stuff matches. Mm-hmm. She's just really young.
She was
15, I think.
15 or 16, yeah. Mm-hmm. So she was a lot younger, but she was out like late, you know, so she mm-hmm. very well. She was seen, I think there was like not too far from home, across from a grocery store at some home.
So if I remember right about her case, she had told her parents she was going to a friend's house, and somebody mm-hmm. took her to her friend's house, but she got there and her friends weren't home. And so she decided to sit down kind of on the sidewalk and wait for him. And then that's the last time she was ever seen, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think, you know, because I think she was last seen out front.
And that would have been in 1988.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that general time frame, it's a little late, but it definitely wouldn't have been the same suspect, obviously, because he was already in prison at that point.
Yeah, and he's the age range is a little bit further out, but mm-hmm. the general traits, I think, are very similar. Mm-hmm. She was 5'2", brown hair. Right.
Mm-hmm. She had kind of feathered hair, but yeah, and I was just like, I was trying to remember what Shanda looked like, and her hair is dark too.
Oh, yeah, Shanda's hair was, so her hair was about shoulder length. She had brown, mm-hmm. and I actually just looked at Brenda's Namus, and she had brown eyes too.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, pretty similar.
I mean, it's like a 10-year age range, because I think Shanda was 24, right?
Yeah. And Paula was only 19, you know.
So. Getting ready to turn 19. She was 18. Mm-hmm. Her birthday was in 3 weeks.
Right.
But, you know, Brewer had been convicted of the attack on the 18-year-old mm-hmm. in 73 anyway. So yep. 18 is, at least he had a conviction on at 18. So we know that at a minimum, 18,
yeah,
you know, would have put a bottom range there. That would be really interesting to look at, actually, to know more about, like, you know, did they have an idea of his motives or...
Yeah. And he's still, like, he's still in prison. He still maintains his innocence. They did have another suspect. Since we don't have all the details about the investigation, we can assume that it was a solid alibi. And that he was a UA football player. We're not going to mention his name. But he apparently had asked Paula out numerous times, according to her friends. And she had always declined. And several articles mentioned that he had called her at least 3 times that night. But he was cleared because he was on a date with another young woman that night. And he also, I guess, passed a polygraph test, which I don't really think says a lot, but
there's but a could, reason they're not could. Admissible.
Yeah. And so I'm not sure what it says about him that he was calling Paula that much when he was on a date, but yeah.
Mama said, if you can't say anything nice, don't say
anything. Well,
I just don't put much stock in polygraphs. I want to. I think they are a good tool.
I agree. Yeah. And we've talked about that.
Yep. But I just.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I think they're a great tool to rattle the suspects or to
potentially
bring to light certain.
And because it depends too. Response. It depends on who's the polygrapher.
Yeah. True.
If they're very crap, true. It's not going to matter.
Yeah. A good polygrapher is going to know, even that if they aren't looking for necessarily the results, they're looking for the way they respond.
Mm-hmm. So. You got to ask the right questions in the right way, with the right words.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about all this, too, we never really hear anything at all about the person she was with that night before this all happened. And so I'm curious, you know. I'm curious what kind of investigation, what kind of alibi, you know, what happened with that.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to know what that kind of entailed, but I would assume that somebody questioned him, but
I'm not really sure. I think so, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, on top of all of this, as usually happens, especially in these older cases, Paula's mom and dad have both passed away since Paula's death. And her mother actually passed away just a few years after her death in 1980. And then her father passed away in 2008. So that's, you know, we always think it's terrible that your kids will die before the parents and that they have to, that they never were able to find out what happened.
Yeah, Dana and I were talking about this one time.
Mm-hmm.
About it, at how I have, think the same way. Like, I would want to know what happened to my child before I passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But Dana has kind of a different perspective on it. And she said she feels like once you pass away, like, you know.
That's true.
You see them again, you know, and it's, so instead of there being kind of this like lingering sadness over the fact that they no longer know what happened, now they do.
Yeah.
And
that's a good thought.
Interesting. And I'm like, that actually is that's a good thought to have, actually.
So answers are more for the living then.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense, actually. It's kind of almost the same thing with grieving, you know, like when they say, well, you know, if somebody doesn't want to have a funeral and they say, well, I'm gone, it doesn't matter, we don't need to have a funeral. But it's really not for them. It's for the people who are left behind. So, interesting. I like that idea. Makes me feel a little better about those cases.
I know. It's just kind of a nice thought. And it's just kind of stuck there in the back of my mind ever since you said it.
Yeah.
I kind of like it. Thanks, Dana.
Yeah, thanks.
She's always got some wise words.
She does.
So Paula's case was brought to us by a cousin who submitted her murder to Uncovered and then to us here at ACCA. Bill's mother used to be in touch occasionally with Paula's brother, Chuck, and we wanted to give a quick thank you to Bill Babington for his part in helping to bring awareness to Paula's case. Her brother now, Dr. Charles Ellis, became a dentist. Side note, he's actually been fondly known as Dr. Chuck and had sort of a unique practice. Displayed on his office walls, he shared a huge celebrity autograph collection that he had accumulated since he was 9 years old.
Can you imagine having a collection that long? I mean, I have collections that I've had for a little while as far as I collect things, but that's a long time.
My mom started a collection of birthday dolls for me.
Oh, yeah? Huh.
I hope they're at her house.
You're going to have to talk to her about that, huh?
I just thought about it. I was like, I'm not entirely sure where they are. I think they're actually still in the china cabinet at her house. I like magnets. I get magnets everywhere we go.
We did that for a while. I got rid of a bunch of them. But especially when we had our camper or our fifth wheel, we were collecting them when we went places.
Then I'll go somewhere like, and I'll forget. So then I have to like pick up like five the next place I stop or something.
Yeah.
But I think that's pretty awesome that he like kept those and then had them framed and in his office.
And he had some pretty neat stories in the article that I read about it.
Actually,
like, one from Mike Tyson.
There was an article titled something about like local dentists rubbing elbows with celebrities.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Yep.
And it looks like his practice is now closed and he's probably retired because he's, I think, in his early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry if you're not. But he has carried the heavy and difficult work of trying to find the answers to his sister's murder. And we tried to track down some contact information for Dr. Ellis so that we could reach out to him because he did talk to Crimson White. And we don't normally like to reach out to the families if they haven't contacted us directly because sometimes you don't really want to reopen those wounds if they don't really want to. But he seemed pretty open to discussing it. And
so Dr. Ellis, if you happen to be listening to this and would like to call us, please do.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, he was redirected to this investigator or that investigator, or this person might have, you know, evidence for that because he tried to track down what they didn't have and was unsuccessful in doing so. And that hurts my heart for him.
Yeah,
actually,
it does.
A lot. Dr. Ellis was quoted in the Birmingham Post talking about Paula's murder. I don't think my mother ever got over it. Speaking of her death in 1980, you learn to live with it because you have to. But I still think, why did it have to happen to her? What a waste of life. Sometimes I feel angry and I want someone to be punished. It makes it harder to forgive not knowing.
Right.
Pretty on point words.
Yeah, yeah. Captain Kennedy, we'd like to thank you for your time. And to all you, here he is with some closing comments.
Go ahead, get ready. It ain't Ted Bundy. It's going to come up. It's going to come up immediately. And there's reasons for it. There's reasons for it to believe that, too. It's similar to his first murder.
Yeah.
He was, this is early for him, but he was killing women at this time.
Right.
Out west or in Oregon. And, you know, he did finally, after he got escaped from prison and everything, he did go to, you know, he killed girls at Florida State. And he got arrested in Mobile, Alabama. And they have a day-by-day timeline of him. And the weeks, the months of this murder, he is on the timeline being known to be in Oregon.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
But that's going to come up immediately.
Paula's case is still open.
Right.
And, you know, if there is there anything you'd like to tell somebody who has a tip, you know, or something that maybe they just might not realize is a tip?
Right, right. See, yes. Most cases like this, the perpetrator is someone that is known to the victim. And that's very possible in this case as well. But either way, whoever did this, working these types of cases, you know, somebody out there knows something. Somebody said something or behaved in a strange manner or has intimated to another person in their life that they may have information or know or have participated in some degree with this crime. And if that is true, even if you don't know for 100% certainty if it's true, I would rather you call me and let me look into it and determine whether or not it has anything to do with it or not, then keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we're after. So we need, you know, just because you think someone may have said something that may or may not, but it has always bothered you, it's been a nagging feeling that this person said this or talked about this, if that is something that if it's bothering you, then I want it to bother me. Right? Mm-hmm. I want to find out, and I can maybe put it to bed. Right? Mm-hmm. But you never know. There's no harm at all in letting me know. No one will be arrested based on that fact. That information can be anonymous, but anything like that we can get, that could be a lead that we can consult with our case files and then investigate that person further. And, of course, everything requires evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't arrest folks without evidence, and we have to have probable cause, and we want much more than that because we want a successful prosecution as well. And we want to make sure that we're doing the right thing and charging the correct person. So don't worry about us going out and arresting someone based on your say-so. That is in no way enough. But if you have anything, any person has ever mentioned anything to you or you think that there's somebody that may have any information or be responsible for Paula Ellis's murder, by all means, give me a call.
And how can they get a hold of you or the sheriff's office? What's the best way to do that?
The best way would be to call the Violent Crimes its main number, which is 205-464-8690. My name's Captain Jack Kennedy, and my email is jkennedy@tcsoal.org.
Perfect. I appreciate that.
With the caveat that it's not Ted Bundy, because I don't need a million people calling and saying Ted Bundy. I promise you they're going to.
If you were at the University of Alabama campus, or at the concert, you may have taken some pictures at or even before the event. We found the concert was called the Spring Rave Up and might have been especially memorable because of this. You may have seen her on a bicycle before or leaving her dorm before the festival. As Captain Kennedy said, nothing is too small. Make the call to Tuscaloosa County Sheriff's Office or email the captain. If you feel more comfortable, you can also contact Crime Stoppers at 205-752-7876. That's 205-752-STOP. Or as always, you may also contact us here at ACCA on our website, alcoldcase.com. We'll have all the details for the contact information in our episode description as usual. Let's solve Paula's case.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Spotify for Podcasters, available on your favorite podcast platform. Intro music for the show was created by Principles of Uncertainty, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Content and production is by Sellers and Stormy. Artwork by Sellers. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and any source referenced in our podcast can be found in each episode's description. We hope you will join us on all the major social media sites and continue to raise awareness of our Alabama cold cases. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.